Emily Dickinson was a mystery. For well over 100 years, people have spent as much time analyzing and pondering her life as they have her poetry. In many ways, they were the same: secretive, enigmatic, and unconventional. In other ways, they were paradoxes. She was shy. Her poetry was bold. She was plain. Her poetry was striking. And while Emily hid in her room, her poetry explored the universe. Emily Dickinson was born December 10th, 1830, in Amherst, Massachusetts, in the same house she spent almost every day of her life. She gained no recognition or fame in her own time, and even her own parents, with whom she lived until they died, never knew their daughter was a gifted writer. In the mid-18th century, Amherst was a remote Puritan village, population 3,000, located a full day's journey from any city. Although the surrounding hillsides were lovely, in summer Amherst was sluggish and dull, and in winter it was desolate and freezing, temperatures hovering near zero. But Emily and her entire family were deeply attached to the town and left only when they had to. "We're the birds who stay," she said. Among the many signatures she used to sign her letters, one was simply Amherst. Because of Amherst College, the town had a lively intellectual community. In spite of its remoteness, it also had more ministers per capita than any other town in the nation. Emily resisted the weekly sermons and the pressure on her to become a Congregationalist. She said she loved the world too much to give it up for Christ. And yet by the time she was only 23, she had already begun to turn her back on it. The Dickinsons were a respected family with early New England roots and a dedication to learning and public causes. Emily's father, Edward, had been valedictorian at Yale and was a successful lawyer. With help from Noah Webster, Emily's grandfather had founded Amherst College, which he envisioned as a stronghold for the Calvinist faith. All the Dickinsons had been Calvinists, rigid, austere, and joyless in their faith. Her father was forceful and dominating. Her mother, also named Emily, was passive, weak, and, as Emily said, not given to thought. Emily had an older brother named Austin and a younger sister named Lavinia. Austin was active in the community and served on the board of the college. Lavinia was a homebody like Emily. The Dickinson house on Main Street was a large, drafty brick building which the neighbors called a mansion. It had classical columns in the front, servants' quarters in the rear, and over 20 rooms that were difficult to heat in winter. The house was screened from the street by large elms and hemlock hedges. When Emily was 6 years old, her father launched a political career that took him first to the state legislature, then the state senate, and then the U.S. Congress. He was an ambitious man, stern and rational, remote and unemotional. He favored his son Austin and barely noticed Emily. Edward Dickinson compared the letters Austin wrote to those of Shakespeare, yet he never read even one poem written by Emily. She, however, never judged him harshly and seemed to sympathize with his emotional poverty. As Edward Dickinson's responsibilities increased, he spent more and more time away from home, and Emily was left in the care of her timid and dependent mother. Mrs. Dickinson was increasingly an invalid over the last 30 years of her life and remains a vague, shadowy figure in Emily's own life. Emily once told a friend, "I never had a mother. I suppose a mother is one to whom you hurry when you are troubled." Emily first attended a local grammar school, then was sent to a neighboring town for her high school education. The schools were religious and strict, but the education was far superior to the standard of the day. At school, Emily was known for her wit, humor, and scholarliness. She was popular with her classmates and impressed her teachers, who saw her as gifted but physically delicate and nervous. She grew increasingly homesick at school, was frequently absent because of illness, and so depressed when a friend died that she withdrew for 2 months. The next fall, she stayed home the entire semester because she was low in spirits. When she returned, she stayed for only 6 months because of a continuous cough. Her letters home referred often to depression and tears. By the time she was 17, she finally finished her education and returned once more to Amherst. all three of the Dickinson children stayed at home or close to home for their entire lives. Neither Emily nor Lavinia ever married, and both lived in the family house until they died. Austin married and lived in a house next door, which his father built. His wife was a young woman who had been Emily's best friend at school. But it was an unhappy marriage, and one that caused Emily much sadness. Emily and Lavinia were exceptionally close, and Lavinia, although the younger, often took care of Emily like a mother. In fact, Emily once wrote, "I have no parents but her." Emily always remembered, as did all of Amherst, an Independence Day fire that destroyed a large portion of the town. The Dickinsons were in bed when the warning bells rang, and the flames, which could be seen from their windows, had come frighteningly close. Vinny tiptoed into Emily's room and told her the kind of soothing lie one tells. "Don't be afraid, Emily," she whispered. "It's only the 4th of July." Then she led her out of the room by her hand, still reassuring her, "It's only the 4th of July." Emily wrote later to her cousins, "Vinny's 'only the 4th of July' I shall always remember. I think she will tell us so when we die, to keep us from being afraid." Whenever Lavinia left home on a visit, Emily felt scared and vulnerable. During one of these visits, when the weather was especially hot, she locked every window shut and kept the gas jets lit all night. She wrote that her fears at this time gave her a snarl in the brain which don't unravel yet. Describing her bond with Lavinia, or Vinny as she called her, Emily said it was early, earnest, indissoluble. Without her, life were fear. At home, Emily was in charge of the greenhouse and gardening. Lavinia did the household chores. The Dickinsons had servants to do the cooking, but Emily liked to cook and bake special delicacies sometimes. Her bread-making, according to her father, was unequaled. So every day, it was Emily's responsibility to make sure her father had an ample supply of it. Emily had a deep admiration for nature and the natural sciences, and once wrote, "When flowers annually die, and I was a child, I used to read Dr. Hitchcock's book on the flowers of North America. This comforted me their absence, assuring me they lived." Dr. Hitchcock was a leading biologist and geologist who was president of Amherst College. Many of Emily's poems were on themes of nature and science. Her other favorite topics were love, God, death, and immortality, often using nature as a metaphor. Nature for Emily was usually an allegory of human life. She bravely tackled these profound topics at a time when women writers were expected to confine themselves to the domestic and sentimental. Emily Dickinson also loved riddles, and many of her poems are designed to make the reader guess just whom or what she is describing. Like this one, which she confided to a friend, was about a hummingbird. "A root of evanescence with a revolving wheel, a resonance of emerald, a rush of cochineal, and over blossom on the bush adjusts its tumbled head, the mail from Tunis probably, an easy morning's ride." Before she was 30, Emily made only about a half dozen trips away from home, mostly for pleasure, but sometimes to seek medical help for her eyes, which were a persistent problem to her. But as early as when she was 22, Emily began to go out of her way to avoid people, attending church first thing in the morning so she wouldn't have to, in her words, go in after all the people had got there. By the time she was 28, it was her habit to run every time the doorbell rang. By the time she was 30, she would retreat to her room when friends visited and listen to their voices from upstairs. The following year, when she was 31, Emily adopted the habit of dressing exclusively in white, a habit she kept until she died 24 years later. The dressmaker never saw her. Instead, she sent Lavinia as a stand-in for her fittings. Until they died, both Lavinia and Emily dressed and groomed themselves in the fashions of young girls. The year she donned white was also the year Emily begged her cousins to take her place at a commencement tea at home for Amherst College, because she felt, in her words, too hopeless and scared to face visitors. Eventually, she secluded herself behind her doors altogether until, for the last 15 years of her life, No one saw her but her immediate family. In 1881, at the time Emily was 51, a woman who lived in Amherst wrote to her parents about her eccentric neighbor. "I must tell you about the character of Amherst. It is a lady whom the people call the Myth. She is a sister of Mr. Dickinson and seems to be the climax of all the family oddity. She has not been outside of her house in 15 years, except once to see a new church, when she crept out at night and viewed it by moonlight. She dresses wholly in white, and her mind is said to be perfectly wonderful. She writes finely, but no one ever sees her. Her sister invited me to come and sing to her mother sometime. People tell me that the Myth will hear every note. She will be near, but unseen." In earlier years, although Emily was growing more and more reclusive, she still had access to many prominent and interesting people, mostly through her father's work, and through her brother, who was a lawyer. These included editors, clergymen, judges, educators, and writers. She may have even met one of her idols, Ralph Waldo Emerson, for he was once a house guest of her brother, who lived right next door. Still, her favorite place was always alone in her room or taking long walks with her shaggy brown dog, Carlo. Emily chose to think and write in her own society rather than the society outside, which failed so at understanding her. One of her poems reads, "The soul selects her own society, then shuts the door. On her divine majority, obtrude no more." No one can be sure when Emily Dickinson first began writing, but it seems to have been in her early 20s. Her most productive and crucial years were between 1858 and 1864, during the Civil War. It was then that she began to sew packets of poems together to keep them safe. The war affected her little. She seldom mentioned it in her letters, and wrote to a friend, "War feels to me in a bleak place." But something, and there have been many guesses as to what, seemed to trigger an internal struggle or crisis that resulted in a great burst of creativity. Many have guessed at an unrequited love. Others have suspected it was a religious dilemma. Emily lived in a strongly Puritan community, had attended strictly religious schools, and was raised by a stern Calvinist father. Yet she herself was skeptical and wavered about her beliefs. Some of her poems are devotional. Others are doubtful. Her tone about religion and God ranges from mischievous and witty to sincere and awestruck. Whatever her crisis, if there was one, from 1862 to 1863, when she was in her early 30s, Emily averaged a poem a day. It was also during this time that she made the crucial contact of a friend named Thomas Higginson. Higginson had just written an article in the Atlantic Monthly, advising young writers on how to get published, and admonishing them that poetry must have life, that it must breathe. Emily sent him 4 poems and dutifully asked him, "Is my verse alive?" pleading with him to be honest. She chose Higginson probably not just because of his article, but also because he was known to be interested in social causes, including the rights of women. From then on, Emily used Higginson as her guide, critic, and confidant, sending him volumes of letters and poems over the years. Higginson was intrigued by her. He recognized her uniqueness, but he found it too unique. He was a traditionalist, confused by her unconventional rhymes and style, which are recognized today as the forerunner of modern poetry. He chastised her, told her to strive for more regularity, and said her works weren't ready for publication. She wrote back to him, "You think my gait spasmodic? I am in danger, sir. You think me uncontrolled? I have no tribunal." In a later letter, in which she enclosed other poems, she asked, "Are these more orderly? I thank you for the truth. I had no monarch in my life and cannot rule myself, and when I try to organize, my little force explodes and leaves me bare and charred." The world can ever be grateful that, although she considered herself his pupil, Emily allowed her little force to explode and never took his literary advice. Higginson failed to recognize genius. Emily, for her part, failed to recognize a critic unworthy of her. When she was 39 years old, Emily finally had a face-to-face meeting in her house with Higginson. The meeting took place more than 8 years after they'd started corresponding, and it made a profound impact on him. Emily introduced herself by handing him 2 orange lilies and apologizing for her timidity. "I never see strangers and hardly know what to say," she murmured. Higginson was uneasy with her and told his wife, "I never was with anyone who drained my nerve power so much. Without touching her, she withdrew from me." Although he still admired the spark of originality he saw in her, Higginson found her eccentricities too much to bear. "An instinct told me," he said, "that the slightest attempt at direct cross-examination would make her withdraw into her shell. The impression undoubtedly made on me was that of an excess of tension and of an abnormal life." Readers, fans, and scholars love to theorize about Emily's seclusion. Among the reasons put forth as to why she retreated are a frustrated love affair, devotion to her writing, meditation on spiritual and metaphysical questions, a ploy to make her dull life seem more dramatic, protection of her vulnerability and sensitivity, disdain for society and conformity, a reaction to her repressive schooling, spitefulness for her father, and last and certainly least, because she was so plain in looks. There have been numerous speculations over the years as to whether Emily Dickinson was ever in love, and if so, who that person might have been. Many of her poems speak of love and lovers, which, if taken on a literal, worldly level, would indicate both joyous and devastating experiences. After her death, private love letters she wrote were found, but it's impossible to know if she actually ever sent them, if they were copies, or if they were simply writing exercises. They are passionate, heavily edited, and addressed to no specific name. Usually she refers to her lover as Master, or You. For a long time, people believed she had a romance with a minister named Charles Wadsworth, who moved to San Francisco in 1862, allegedly breaking Emily's heart. Later in life, she made some sentimental comments about her friendship with Wadsworth, but whether there was more beneath the surface remains a mystery. There has also been speculation that she was in love with Samuel Bowles, an editor and close friend of her brother's. Bowles was one of the few who didn't cater to her seclusion and quirkiness. It's said that once when he visited the house, and Emily, as typical, stayed in her room, he bellowed up the stairs, "Emily, you damned rascal, no more of this nonsense. I've traveled all the way from Springfield to see you. Come down at once." The story is that she came down immediately and was never more vivacious or witty. Emily tried to interest Bowles in her poetry, but he never took it seriously enough to read it. His disinterest caused her much pain. There is one romance Emily definitely did have, and that was with a judge named Otis Lord, a member of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. It came late in her life, when she was in her 50s, too late and after too many years at home to lead to matrimony. Lord returned her love and seemed to have proposed, for in one of her surviving letters she gave him a gentle rejection. "Don't you know you are happiest while I withhold and don't confer? Don't you know that no is the wildest word we consign to language?" In her middle age, Emily read continuously and kept up her enormous correspondence with a small circle of friends. She described the dictionary as her constant companion, and books as her strongest friend. She took a great interest in literature by other women, her favorite writers being the Brontes, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and George Eliot. About Eliot's greatest novel, she said, "What do I think of Middlemarch? What do I think of Glory?" Emily wrote her poems in private, often late at night, but ideas could come at any time, night or day. She often jotted them down on scraps of brown grocery paper, on the margins of newspapers, alongside advertisements, whatever happened to be handy when the little force exploded. She would copy them in her room, seated by her stove for warmth. They were always written in ink, then sewed up in bunches and placed in her cherry wood dresser. 900 of them were discovered there by an astonished Lavinia after Emily had died. All totaled, she wrote 1,775 poems. They are admired today for their wit, bold imagery, originality of style, and the depth of their observation and questioning. Emily Dickinson did not crave fame and seemed early on to accept and even prefer that her poems wouldn't be published. "How can you print a piece of your own soul?" she asked. Although she sought the opinion of Higginson on what she wrote, she made no efforts to convince others to publish her work. When friends encouraged her to do so, she stood firm. However, she did send poems to friends as gifts, included them in her letters, and shared them with her family. But these make up only a small percentage of her total output. Her view on fame was clearly stated in one of her most famous verses. "I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody, too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'll advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog. To tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog." Emily never gave her poems titles, and most of them weren't dated. They are known by their first line, such as, "I'm nobody, who are you?" Like Higginson, the first publishers who printed Emily's work after her death were afraid the readers would be offended by her strange rhythms and innovative use of the language. They even edited her work to make it sound more conventional. But Emily herself used a different criteria to judge her work than just meter and rhythm and rhyme and conformity. She said, "If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry." Although she wrote up until her last years, Emily became less and less prolific as time went on. She also became less and less sociable. Friends who wanted to see her had to follow strict rules. They were required to come to her house, which she never left, even to cross the ground to her brother's house. Even after they arrived, they couldn't be certain she'd appear. Often, she preferred instead to converse from opposite sides of a door left partly ajar. As she grew older, direct visits became extremely rare, and almost all communications with friends were through letters. Inside, the house was quiet and dark, with heavy furniture and curtains that were always drawn. The air was fragrant from flowers. When Emily was 43, her father died suddenly, and the house was filled with visitors from the funeral. Emily would not come out, and she saw no one except her dear friend Samuel Bowles. The time of her father's death marked the beginning of her complete seclusion. Later, when Bowles died, she didn't accompany her sister and brother to his funeral, but arrangements were made to have some of the music repeated in her house while she listened from upstairs. She did a similar thing when her own mother died. She listened to the entire funeral service from upstairs and remarked that the singing seemed to be coming from another life. She couldn't even bear to see her own brother's wife, who lived next door, but told her it was because of idolatry, not indifference. When the Dickinson servant sometimes approached her to ask for instructions, she would run from the room. Emily's reticence wasn't just confined to people. For instance, she couldn't or wouldn't wrap packages or address envelopes. Her sister addressed her letters for her so that even Emily's handwriting couldn't be seen by the world. She seemed unable to expose herself to the world in any form, directly or indirectly. A year after her father died, Emily's mother was paralyzed with a stroke, lingering for 7 more years, in which she required constant nursing care. Emily took great pleasure in caring for her mother and said these were the years when affection between them finally blossomed. Her mother, in her helplessness, became sweeter, and Emily thrived on being of service. She spoke of the ecstatic experience she had just in preparing a delightful meal for her mother. About the time she finally discovered a bond with her mother, Emily discovered another new joy. She was well into middle age when she suddenly became enamored of children. In the same period her mother was declining, Emily's brother and sister-in-law had a baby they named Gilbert. Since they only lived next door, Emily had ample opportunities to become a doting aunt, which is exactly what she did. She especially delighted in Gilbert's rebellious antics and sayings, and repeated them in letters to her friends. So devoted was she to Gilbert that she began to refer to him as "our child" and "my son." Because of Gilbert, Emily began to appreciate all children more. She once called a neighborhood boy into the house to show him a butterfly that had just emerged from a chrysalis in her greenhouse, an extraordinary move for one so reclusive. The boy remembered for years how happy and eager she'd been to share her beautiful discovery with him. Another time, unable to overcome her reticence, she lowered a basket containing fresh gingerbread to some children playing on the lawn outside the house. From then on, the neighborhood children frequently peeked through the tall hemlock hedge to get a glimpse of her, but they were seldom successful. Most extraordinary, Emily set aside her vow never to publish her poems when a children's charity asked to print them. She submitted 3 poems to the charity, explaining it later by saying, "The name of Child was a snare to me." The loss of her mother and of little Gilbert all in the same year was the cruelest experience Emily ever had, and was the beginning of her own decline. Gilbert was 8 years old when he suddenly fell ill. Emily, frantic with worry, overcame all her fears to leave the house, cross the expansive lawn, and enter her brother's house for the first time in 15 years. The experience was so jarring that she developed an agonizing pain in the back of her head and began to vomit. Just the same, she stayed at Gilbert's bedside until he died. Then she collapsed and, very ill herself, was confined to bed for 2 months. In spite of her reclusive life, Emily Dickinson was no stranger to suffering. She had deep insight into the process of human loss and pain, as evidenced in one of her most famous poems, which describes the great void that descends after one has experienced a death of desire or ego. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious like tombs. The stiff heart questions, "Was it he that bore, and yesterday or centuries before?" The feet, mechanical, go round, a wooden way of ground or air or aught, regardless grown, a quartz contentment like a stone. This is the hour of lead, remembered, if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow. First a chill, then stupor, then the letting go. In the few years left to her after Gilbert's death, Emily turned her attention to Gilbert's little friends, sending them letters and mailing them cakes at Christmas time. She wrote, "Missing my own boy, I knock at other trundle beds." Emily outlived her mother and Gilbert by only 4 years. She had suffered for some years from kidney problems, but although she would see doctors, they were not allowed to examine her. Instead, she would walk by the door, fully clothed, and expect them to make a diagnosis on the basis of a glimpse of her. She died in 1886, at the age of 55, from a renal or kidney disorder listed on her death certificate as Bright's disease. It said that she looked far younger than her age. Emily's instructions for her funeral were very specific and reflected the deep attachment she had to her house. The 6 Irishmen employed as groundskeepers were to carry her coffin out the back door, around through the garden, through the barn from the front to back, and then through the grassy fields to the family plot, always in sight of the house. She was buried dressed in white, holding 2 white flowers and resting inside a white coffin. At her burial, poems by Emily Bronte were read. After Emily's death, her sister Lavinia, with the help of a friend, dedicated themselves to having her poems published. They were successful, and from that point on, Emily Dickinson joined the ranks of the world's most influential poets. With Walt Whitman, she is the leading poet of the 19th century America, a period that has been called the American Literary Renaissance. Emily Dickinson had a rare gift that, like many gifts, exacted a special price. She seemed to have emotional responses to people in life that were so deep and acute they were difficult to bear. Her feelings were more intense than most, her awareness more enhanced. And although this is what empowered her writing, it is also what gave even the most ordinary experiences an emotional charge that drained her vital energy. So she did what she had to protect herself and her art. Her extreme privacy was an attempt to control experiences to which she had uncommonly strong reactions. It was a life of purpose, in which she consciously took charge so she could dedicate herself to her art. She chose seclusion out of respect for her vocation and created an environment where she could live out her own inner life. The real myth about Emily Dickinson is that she lived an empty and unfulfilled life. Her dedication and love for her craft, even though it was unrecognized by the public, and the sheer wealth of her mind, ranks her life among the richest and deepest. In her little room on the second floor of her quiet house, she was endlessly exploring her emotional, intellectual, and spiritual existence. Even though isolated from the world in person, she was fully involved in her mind and soul. Personal experiences may not have been hers, but universal experiences were, for she was sensitive to both the joys and anguish of everyday existence. And although surrounded by the ordinary, from that she extracted the extraordinary. In the end, she is the proof that no life, however and wherever lived, can be remote.
This is the end of the session.